did for the good of the realm. The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left once we abandon the lie?
Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all.
Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail and never get to try again. The fall breaks them. And some are given a chance to climb, but they refuse. They cling to the realm. Or the gods. Or love. Illusions. Only the ladder is real. The climb is all there is.
You gotta climb that ladder, boys and girls. You gotta climb that ladder. Yeah. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in sunny, sultry California today. Yeah, and it is the 2nd of August, 2017. The day of Wotan. Yeah, this is Wotan's day. David Lane's favorite day. So let's get on with the show. We're going to delve into this Venezuelan situation. I've been watching this thing very carefully. And I know the CIA's down there. Whenever there begins to be riots in the streets, you can bet your bottom dollar the CIA's involved deeply. So I want to go over to the left here and see what they've got to say about Venezuela.
Turn to my guest this week and to talk about an issue that is of such critical importance right now in this historical moment. We've talked a number of times about Venezuela, about the ongoing situation in Venezuela, but it does seem to be coming to a critical mass in some ways, and so I'm very happy to be able to welcome Dr. Francisco Dominguez to the podcast. Francisco is a professor of Latin American Studies at Middlesex University in London. He is also the National Secretary for the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign. Follow their work and their material on the website venezuelasolidarity.co.uk. That's www.venezuelasolidarity.co.uk. Francisco, welcome to Counterpunch Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about Venezuela in this particular moment, because, you know, it's something we've all, obviously all of us on the left, have been talking about for a lot of years, going back to the rise of Chavez in the late 1990s and, of course, the transformation, the Bolivarian process. But it does seem that we are at a very critical moment, one perhaps one could say at an existential crisis moment in Venezuela. Can you start out our conversation by just explaining to some of our listeners, well, A, whether you agree that we're really in an existential crisis moment, and what that actually looks like? Why are we at such a crisis right now?
Yeah, I think the threats against the Bolivarian Revolution are absolutely gigantic right now. It's never been like this before, although the revolution has been under siege and under attack anyway since 1999 when it began. But I think what happened now is this. When Hugo Chavez died prematurely on the 5th of March 2013, U.S. imperialism and the right wing internationally and also the right wing in Venezuela came to the conclusion, which they persuaded themselves of, that this was a one-man revolution, and therefore, once Chavez died, it would be easy to push it out of existence. And they immediately turned a nasty economic war against it, which has been going on ever since, which is reminiscent of the economic war they launched against Salvador Allende back in the 1970s in Chile, with very well-known horrible results. This paid off in a way, because the consequences on the people, the hoarding of basic necessities, the hoarding of food items, forcing people to go up and so on. In other words, punishing the people as much as possible for having elected these governments. They won the national election for the elections for the National Assembly in 2015. In that sense, it worked. Throughout 2016, the majority, the right-wing majority in the National Assembly, tried everything in their power, legal, illegal, criminal, or otherwise, to oust the government of Maduro. And because of the existing constitution, which they couldn't really get rid of, they failed miserably. By 2017, they realized that their strategy domestically was not working, so they turned towards the Organization of American States in order to justify an external sanction that will legitimize not only internal subversion, but also external intervention, particularly by the United States, ideally from their point of view, with the military dimension. They tried everything. Luis Almagro tried absolutely everything in his power, calling the Permanent Council of the Organization of American States to a meeting literally every 48 hours, again and again and again. And they failed miserably again because they couldn't get enough sufficient support in the region in order to do what they wanted to, which was to apply the Democratic Charter, suspend Venezuela from the organization, create the conditions for their meddling into the internal affairs of Venezuela, and bring the United States in. That failed. Because many countries in the region were reluctant to go for that option, even though many of them don't like what they see in the Bolivarian Revolution because it's too radical for them, they were not prepared all the way, so they launched a wave of violence in order to persuade them that this was, you know, there were sufficient grounds for them to support this. And this is what we are facing now. 90, nearly 100 days of horrible violence, trying to oust the government, using every imaginable terrorist tactic, which we can talk about in a second. And this failed again. And therefore, the United States, Rex Tillerson, decided to go to the European Union to try to persuade the European Union to apply sanctions jointly with the United States against Venezuela. This also failed miserably, and the latest effort, which was literally 2 days ago, 1 day ago, they tried to get Mercosur, the common market of the South countries, which are basically dominated by the extreme right wing, you know, Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, and they failed again to actually apply sanctions from it. So now they are stuck, and what happened then? The United States, Donald Trump, decided that the masks were off. And he said the United States was going to apply sanctions to Venezuela in order to try to resolve the problem by telling the Venezuelans how to vote, who to vote for, and which institution they should elect, which is completely ridiculous and totally unacceptable. And this is what we're facing, and the Venezuelan Revolution is fighting for its life.
I think that that's absolutely correct. Now, one point that I want to kind of put out, up front, because I think it's important, is the fact that all throughout the previous 8 years, the Obama administration was absolutely belligerent towards Venezuela, including calling Venezuela a national security threat. Of course, totally absurd from the U.S. perspective. Funding various paramilitary organizations and all forms of destabilization. However, all of that said, it does seem that with the Donald Trump administration coming in, all of these tactics have been multiplied exponentially. The pressure has been added and increased against the Bolivarian Revolution. And so I want to ask two questions. Number one, do you agree that the Trump administration is even more belligerent towards Venezuela? And number two, how much of that is related to Rex Tillerson and ExxonMobil and their longstanding feud with Hugo Chavez and the socialist government in Venezuela, which refused to allow ExxonMobil to dominate the oil industry in that country? So the question really is, how much of the current situation that we're seeing is related to the previous 15 years?
Well, it is related in the sense that they've been trying, the United States, you know, using every mechanism, channeling huge amounts of money to the National Endowment for Democracy, to opposition groups in Venezuela of every kind, political parties, so-called NGOs, media outfits, television channels, politicians, and so on. to the tune of between 2002-2013, to the tune of £120 million, which to the scale of the United Kingdom, this is something like $1 billion, £1 billion, that a foreign hostile power is given to subversive groups domestically in order to oust and destroy the democracy of the country. This is what we're talking about. So it was horrible before, and it's still horrible. I think what is going on now is this. Whatever Mr. Trump may think about Venezuela, I'm not sure he knows too much about it. I think at the moment, because he's in real trouble domestically, for all sort of internal domestic reasons, he has decided to actually capitulate to the pressure of the extreme right wing in Florida, the Miami Cuban American mafia. And as a result of that, he is prepared to concede even undoing some of the positive, you know, not completely good, but some of the positive work that Obama did regarding normalizing relations with Cuba. And now he has decided to do exactly the same with Venezuela. We have to wait and see. You know, he's made very threatening statements. We have to wait and see what he does rather than what he says he's going to do. He says he's threatening Venezuela if they continue and go ahead with the Constituent Assembly this next week. And he says he's going to take all sorts of measures. So far, he hasn't clarified exactly what it is. It seems to me, in that sense, the foreign policy of the administration towards Venezuela, towards Cuba, and certainly towards Latin America, has been, you know, given over to the worst possible elements of the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, particularly in Florida. Regarding the overall strategic reason as to why the United States has been doing this in 1999 and is intensifying it now, is because Rex Tillerson is extremely central to the whole strategy of the United States to try to oust the Bolivarian government ever since he came to office in 1999, which is called oil. Yep. There's no other reason, really. And the reason is this. Venezuela has the largest deposits of oil certified in the planet. At the current level of consumption in the world, Venezuela has oil for the next 300 years. And even more important than that is good oil, good quality oil, and it's about 5 days away from the United States. That is to say, the moment you ship oil to the United States from Venezuela, it takes about 4 to 5 days to reach Texas, whereas the oil that is coming from the Middle East takes in the region of 30 to 48 days. You can imagine from the strategic point of view how important it is, how significant it is for the United States. They've been trying desperately, and that's why Rex Tillerson has done everything in his power, including, you know, personally talking to the foreign minister of Spain, Dastis, about 5-6 days ago to try to persuade him to initiate, you know, a process in the European Union to persuade the European Union to apply sanctions to Venezuela. And interestingly, they have their own contradictions. Dastis told him, no way, Jose, as we say over here.
Indeed. Now, there's two aspects to this oil question that I think are interesting to examine. Number one is, of course, the 2014 collapse of global oil prices, which obviously really rocked Venezuela's economic situation, of course, above and beyond just the various other forms of economic subversion. The collapse of oil prices hit Venezuela very hard. At the same time, the collapse of oil prices also made things like hydraulic fracturing or fracking and various other domestic energy production industries in the United States less profitable. So it's almost kind of a paradoxical situation vis-a-vis Venezuela. On the one hand, Venezuela is hurt, obviously, by the collapse of global oil prices. On the other hand, the United States remains more dependent on Venezuelan oil because U.S. energy production is now less profitable. So Venezuela finds itself sort of in this double-targeted frame.
No, absolutely. This is absolutely right. I think fracking has become a boomerang because it's hitting the United States quite badly.
Exactly.
One thing is to go for fracking and the level of investment. I mean, you get oil very quickly, but the level of investment for every single drilling that you do is extremely expensive, and you cannot extract more oil from that particular position, different from, you know, the oil that you extract from a deposit. where you can establish your operation and you can stay there for about 20 years. In this case, it's about a few months maybe, and then you have to move on to do it somewhere else in order to get more oil. And therefore, the organic composition of capital, to use a more traditional terminology, increases dramatically, thereby declining the rate of profit quite dramatically. And many other, you know, oil companies in the United States, not the big ones, but certainly medium-sized ones and smaller ones, are suffering the consequences. They are beginning to go bankrupt. So this is not working. And therefore, what it is that it's not sustainable. As a result of the United States embarking itself on the adventure of fracking, I would say, not only is undermining its own internal environment quite badly, you know, this is going to hit them back very badly later on when they see the consequences, but now Venezuela is more important than that. So therefore, as a result of the stupid actions of the United States, very short-sighted, and imperialist ones, Venezuela now has become more under attack, not because of what they're doing, but because of the fault of the United States, which is completely not only unfair, but, you know, ridiculous.
Absolutely. And in fact, regional conflicts developing out of a lot of this sort of calculus. For instance, the United States and particularly ExxonMobil has been, you know, kind of sort of covertly backing the government of Guyana, which has an ongoing territorial waters dispute with Venezuela going back 100 years. But it's now at the forefront because it is now understood to be a massive deposit of oil and gas under the water outside of Venezuela and Guyana's territorial boundaries. And so again, we see a government in Guyana directly backed by ExxonMobil and the United States essentially saber-rattling against Venezuela, Venezuela doing the same back, creating regional conflicts, creating conflicts in the Organization of American States, in Mercosur, border conflicts. This is the type of chaos strategy that the United States seems to be employing in Latin America, the quote-unquote traditional backyard of the empire.
Yeah, it doesn't only seem to be applying, it is applying them.
Yes.
However, this is not working. I think the reason is this. Throughout the period of, you know, the offensive from the Organization of American States, which was not really the Organization of American States making decisions, it was just Luis Almagro, the General Secretary, you know, campaigning to get meeting after meeting after meeting, and the media reporting this as if it was the Organization of American States doing it. It wasn't. The Organization of American States took only one decision regarding Venezuela, which was on the 2nd of April, where it says, you know, they are concerned about this and the other and so on, violence, polarization, blah, blah, blah.
Now, I hope you realize what fracking is doing to this country. I put on the happy side of fracking yesterday, but it's not a happy thing. They punch, they get as much oil out of the ground as they can, and then they leave and go someplace else. They're punching holes all over the country, and now all over the world. And at the same time, they're screwing with Venezuela because of the oil. They need that oil, but they want to screw around with Venezuela and install their own puppet leader down there. Just remember, the people that are behind this are your enemy. And most of them are conservative right-wingers. Yeah, they are. The people in this empire that want to invade and take over other countries and take all their stuff are your deadly enemy. And we've got to get that straight. We got to get our priorities straight and who our real enemies really are. Because there's nothing really going on today that's good for the white working class Americans at all. For that matter, the working class all over the world. I'm a Jack London man. He was a socialist, a white socialist, and proud of it. That's where we got to get back to, or go forward to. That's where we got to go. We don't stand a chance with this fucking right-wing, conservative, Hollywood, Nazi stuff. We know that's going nowhere. How about this sanction stuff? Trump signing that sanction thing against Russia, which he has absolutely no reason to do. He's talking about the Democrats. He's playing the Democrat game because he says the reason he's signing that bill, that sanctions bill, is because the Russians meddling with the election. Well, he fought tooth and nail and screamed high to high heaven that it was stupid that the Russians didn't interfere, and now he's employing these sanctions and saying the Russians did. I mean, this guy is really out there in la-la land. I just wonder how long this four-star general will last. I mean, I got a feeling he's not going to last too long either, unless he just kicks Trump to the side and says, I'm taking over. These sanctions aren't really going to hurt Russia that much because their system's different than our system. they're going to fail with these sanctions, and it's going to divide up the European countries because they see it's a bunch of bullshit and they're doing business with Russia. So here we go again. The ruling class and the moneyed class in their greed and their banker greed are going to screw themselves into the ground, which ultimately it'll breed war. That's what they're really working on. I see the Empire boys are launching a new website that's aiming to track Russian-backed propaganda on Twitter. So they'll probably say anybody says anything pro-Russian or criticizing the United States government is now going to be on the list, backed by Reuters. I was listening to a guy who wrote a book a while ago. I haven't been able to record it and send it to you. But he was in the CIA, and he blew the whistle on the torture that was going on by the CIA. And Obama had him thrown in prison. But an interesting comment came out. They asked him how he did in prison, and he said he did pretty well. They said, do you have any support in the prison? He said, well, the first support I got were from the Aryans, and they took care of me for a while. And then I went over to the Italian mob, and so then he hung around with the Italian mob, and they made sure he was safe. Now, that's interesting. That first of all, he was protected by the Aryans. Well, let's see what's going on over in Europe. The recent German elections went as predicted. A new right-wing xenophobe party. Alternative for Germany, AfD, has emerged with force and will be in the national parliament in 2017. This development is the unprecedented. Wait a minute, this is from 2016. That's an old story. Well, let's go back to December 1984. See what was going on with Liberty Bell. Yeah. When after a flourish from the orchestra, an actor, bedlight in kimono and his face glistened with grease paint, appears on the stage and sings A Wandering Minstrel Eye. We know very well that he is not a minstrel, is not a Nanki Poo, is not even Japanese, but we never think of him as a liar. When a president of the United States exhibits his fizz on the boob tube and eviscerates that he is going to fight inflation or protect American interests somewhere, we, unless very naive, know that he is just reciting from his script and wooing the boobs with a politician's jabber. So we don't think of him as lying, although we may wish that he would perform in a manner of the Gilbert and Sullivan musical, and so be entertaining instead of boring. We still distinguish, however, between what an actor says on the stage and what he says off stage. And when he appears in the propria persona and professes to be to report what he has personally seen or experienced, we expect him to be truthful or at least plausible. Now this, they're talking about Ronald Reagan. This is back when Ronald Reagan was president. Some of us, therefore, were a little shocked when old Reagan, in a private conference with some of his Jewish patrons, solemnly asserted that he was a witness to the truth of their fictitious Holocaust, because he had been in the army and a photographer in Germany in 1945 and had seen with his own bright eyes the awful wickedness of the Germans, who had exterminated so many millions of God's darlings. Some of us were disappointed that he lied. More were disappointed that he lied so brazenly, when he knew full well that the records available to everyone showed that he was never in Germany or even abroad while he was in the army, and that he fought the war in Hollywood, where he manufactured morale for the men at the front, while preserving his own precious skin from the risk of abrasions. Now there is a politics as such things go in a democracy, a curious phenomenon that we may call the Me Too rule. Although it is just a special case of the old axiom, monkey see, monkey do, when one aspirant to the place in the cast of the extravaganza performed in Washington makes some claim that seems to please the audience, the others who are trying out for the play immediately claim they can do it too, only better. A recent example of that is particularly amusing. Quite a few hopefuls are currently excited by the promotion called the Populist Party, which will collect a fairly large sum of money, obtain a place on the ballot in perhaps a third of the states, and will in those states obtain from 2% to 8% of the votes, possibly 10%, in a few districts, and could conceivably affect one or more states, the choice between two competitors for the job as leading mouthpiece in future productions in the White House theater. The populist candidate for that exalted role is one Robert Bob Richards, whose ingenuity advanced him from the humble origins of the Midwest through various corporate positions to the status in which he is said to have to make his home on a little plot of 6,400 acres near Waco, Texas. While not running businesses in Minneapolis, I have before me a newsletter which purports to quote from a press conference given by Richards, which was broadcast on Thursday, the 5th of July, 1984, at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, over a local television system in California. I naturally have no means of being certain that Richards actually made the statements attributed to him in the newsletter, but I do know from long observation how politicians, even small ones, behave. According to the newsletter, Richards made the three following statements, which are quoted verbatim. One, I believe all people in all races are equal. Two, bring 3.5 million Jews from Israel and put them into Texas, and they would turn Texas into a paradise. Three, I don't believe in Liberty Lobby's anti-Holocaust position. I know the furnaces were a fact. I was there. I know. Passing over the first two assertions, the mind-boggling, if we suppose them to have been meant by the speaker, we may note that the Liberty Lobby thus denounced in the third has been through its weekly publication Spotlight, Richard's principal sponsor, and has given him most of the publicity he has enjoyed, so that it has received a politician's normal thanks to his non-professional supporters. Richard, if I remember right, Richards was an Olympic champion, track champion. He used to have, and if it's the same guy, he used to have him on the back of Wheaties cereal, big picture of him. Richard's statement sounds, of course, as though he were claiming to have been peering from a mouse hole while the awful Germans shoveled God's own into the ovens. But we may charitably suppose that he really was in the army in Europe, was shown some of the small ovens used to cremate the bodies of prisoners who died of a disease, and did not have intelligence enough to take a pencil and paper and calculate how many corpses could have been disposed of in those few ovens, and how many decades would have been required to cremate all the Jews that thereafter rose from their ashes and crawled into the United States. But whatever the explanation, it is obvious that Richards was playing the game of Me Too with old Ronnie. That's what always happens in national hullabaloo that gives many innocents the impression that their opinions count in a democracy. Well, boys and girls, I ran out of steam there for a little bit. I had to take a little rest. Had to go in and give some blood to the doctor this morning, so I guess that had something to do with it. But I've got an idea, and I want to run it by you guys. You know, I used to do all these radio shows with interviews and guests, and I really like to do that because I think it's more exciting. And people can ask me all the questions they want, and I'll lie as much as I can. So think about it. Let me know what you think. Would you like to see me start up a live radio thing? I can do it on Skype, and we can spread the word. Anybody that wants to take on old Terrible Tommy can come on the show. And then we've still got all of our archive shows. So think about that. And I'm going to cut the show a little short today. So happy Wotan's Day, and salute to David Lane. And I'll be back tomorrow on Thor's Day. In the meantime, give him hell. And climb the ladder.